I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Hello, welcome to F1 Explains. This is the official Formula One podcast that answers your questions on the sport we all love. My name is Christian Hugill. This is Katie Osborne.
Well, hello, Christian. It's so nice to be back with you. I'm so glad to be on F1 Explains another time with some rapid fire questions. And of course, that is exactly what this episode is all about. Rapid fire questions. We have Julian Palmer. You might know him from driving, F1 TV, presenter, wealth of knowledge and insights, and F1 TV commentator Alex Jakes as well, who you want on your team if you're going out for a trivia night. And in fact, it is so nice to have them both back on this show. We recently did, and you know what was interesting is there were some unfinished questions, I feel like, at the end of the last Rapid Fire episode. And I'm very excited to take a dive into today's questions to see what we can figure out, what we can tie up those loose ends and everything else. Right, Christian?
Yeah. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Alex and Julian were with us. We ended up going a bit off topic. I think, Julian, you were the first to raise it with none of us fully knew where pole position had come from. Is that right, Julian?
That was right, yeah. But do we now?
Do you still not know where pole position comes from?
I don't know.
Well, we've had a bit of information come to us at F1 Explains HQ through the information hotspot that is producer Chris. The term pole position is apparently from horse racing, where the number one horse starts on the inside of the first row next to the inside pole of the track guardrail. Alex Jakes, F1 knowledge extraordinaire. I didn't know that. Did you?
I didn't know that. And I yet again have appeared on this podcast and learnt something. So we are now 3 for 3.
We're doing our jobs then.
That is exceptional, that stat. We were off to a great start. And just quickly, did you know that a horse has about 16 horsepower? It blew my mind when I found that out. A horse does not have one horsepower. It's for another show. We'll throw it down the road.
Wow. I'm staggered.
There we go. 16 horsepower?
In one horse.
We can't.
Wow, blowing us away.
Leave that thread unpulled. We have to get the answer.
I'm fact checking. Sorry, yeah. It's the maximum output of a horse is around 15 horsepower.
And one horsepower is an average over a distance? Is that where the horsepower originates?
Brief explanation as to what horsepower is, Alex, in motorsport terms.
Yeah, horsepower is the power of the engine powering the car. And as we're on horse racing and Formula One, British Grand Prix used to be held on the perimeter road of Aintree, which hosts the Grand National, which is Britain's most famous horse race.
Turns out you want both Julian and Alex on your team at trivia night.
Guys, let me just give this last bit of information here then. When you average the output of a horse over the course of a workday, it ends up being around one horsepower.
Okay.
Wow.
So it's maybe the horsepower of a day's work of a horse is one horsepower.
Okay.
But a horse in a race, full on engines up 15 horsepower. That's what you're getting in the Kentucky Derby.
I cannot wait to tout F1 Explains while at the Kentucky Derby. It's going to be great.
Yeah, Katie covers the Kentucky Derby, yeah?
You'll blow everyone's mind.
Moving right along, as we're talking about the rapid fire episode, it's very different, and oftentimes it's for our guests, but this time I'm really excited. Christian, drumroll please, we have a question for you.
No one's ever written in and asked a question for me. This is exciting.
It's Jen from Austin, and I wanted to know what your one piece of swag from the US Grand Prix in Austin is that you're going to take home with you. Cheers.
Oh, so I know what this is from. So me and Katie did an episode of this podcast last year from the US Grand Prix. And I said I'm a bit of a sporting merch collector, especially with Formula One.
Yeah. I mean, behind Christian.
Yeah, so behind me, there is a row of Formula One hats that I've collected down the years. And I said on the podcast, I would allow myself to pick up one little souvenir from the weekend. And I'm delighted to exclusively reveal, Jen from Austin, that it was a very cool Circuit of the Americas t-shirt that shows the complex. And I thought it looked very cool. And I liked it. But the lovely people at Williams gave me this Austin Williams hat look that's got Austin, Texas on it. So that was nice of them as well. So yeah, so I actually, Jen, ended up with two little bits from Austin. Can you believe it? There you go.
Yeah, and I do have to let you know as well, Jennifer, that the deliberation for that t-shirt was so incredible. And standing there at the multiple merch trailers,
yes,
because there are so many of them at these events, and it's so cool because there's just so much that you just don't get online. But with Christian was a completely different animal. Yes. And that was an experience in Austin that I'm so grateful that producer Chris and I got to experience.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a magpie. I like to collect things from travels around the world. It just reminds me, that was nice, wasn't it? Right, should we do some actual Formula One chat? We should, because it's a Formula One podcast. This is a question for Jolyon Palmer.
Hi, Katie and Christian. This is Steven from South Carolina. I've been a fan of racing my whole life, but really have gotten into Formula One the last 5 years or so. And my question is about driver styles. I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit more about how they're defined and what impact they may have on teams for like designing the car, driver selection, and any details that you could go into. Like, I had some specific questions like, what are the different attributes or how do they define driver styles? Is it actually quantified somehow? Like, you know, I was thinking like video game stats for a player where you've got different, you know, speed and agility and all that, you know, in a football game. Is that something similar to how drivers are rated? And then finally, do teams like intentionally design their cars to suit certain styles or versus others? Or do teams try to recruit drivers with a specific style? Do they try to actually have both teammates have very similar styles? So anyway, that was my question. Love the podcast. Appreciate it. Thank you. Bye.
I love that. Steven came in from a true motorsports perspective. And Jolyon, as you kind of take a dive into all of those questions that Steven has asked. So thank you for that. I do appreciate it because you can tell if you're a Formula One driver, oftentimes that's different than a NASCAR driver, which is maybe different than a sports car driver, which is different than rally, right? And it can or cannot play into the driving style.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of questions in that question. But the fundamental of driving style is there's different components to driving. And I would advise Stephen to tune into a program I made last winter called Racing ID, where I do try and deep dive the different styles and ways that you can drive a Formula One car. But it ranges from being really aggressive to being super smooth to preferring a little bit of oversteer in the car where the back end's trying to get out, but you can turn in quite quickly. Or you have a really settled rear end of the car and you have a bit of understeer, but you have maybe very good traction. You have confidence to turn in. And the drivers will have pretty subtly different preferences for what they like and what they want from the car. And then because the drivers have a different preference, and it's mainly based on how they've grown up, really, how they've come through the ranks, how they've always been driving. Were they used to having a really sharp front end, but there's a very sort of skittish car, or not? Is there other things? And you adapt your style. Then the other thing is you've got to be adaptable when the car's not suited to your style as well. So there's loads in play with driving style. But in terms of development, the team will build a car based on the driver's feedback. And if the drivers don't have the same feedback, it's quite difficult, and they will naturally tend to put the car more towards the faster driver's style. The greatest example is a Verstappen and Perez. And Max can take a car that's very on the nose. It's really oversteery. It makes it very difficult to drive if you don't have that innate ability that not many drivers do. And Max can cope with it. Whereas someone like Checo struggles a little bit more. But that is the fastest way from the fastest driver to do that. So it's natural the team follows that direction.
And Jolyon, I'm glad you brought up Max Verstappen, because this comes up an awful lot. It also came up when Alex Albon was Max's teammate at Red Bull, and we heard that the car was more oversteery, that the car was more difficult to drive because Max's driving style likes that. Take it back a step further, what exactly do we mean by oversteery, and when it leads into that particular driving style?
Oversteery is when your basic limitation is you're going to spin if you go too quick. So the back end of the car is going to come round and you're literally going to start pirouetting if you go too quick. The opposite of this is understeer, where you come into a corner and if you go too quick, you're just not going to turn and you're going to just drive clean off the road. And that's your two types of crash, two types of things that can go wrong. Either the front doesn't turn and you just drive straight off the road if you're going too quick, or the back comes around and you spin off into the wall. And that's the extreme of both, but the drivers are sort of treading a fine line between those characteristics.
You know, you touched on something there, Jolyon, and I would be curious to know about being innate and having the ability to have being behind the wheel and knowing and feeling and confident because of your own innate abilities versus drivers who are skilled because they have enough experience, and the differences between those two and how that plays into maybe a driving style. Trusting a vehicle because you've done it enough times versus innately comfortable behind the wheel.
I think the first, I got to clarify that Formula One drivers are all, you know, that in any sort of perspective, we're talking about the 0.01% of highly skilled drivers. But when we're defining probably what makes some the greatest and some the very good, then I a lot of it does come down to your what you feel in the car, how you can respond to balance and sliding. And the best way to drive a Formula One car, if you're going to be as quick as possible, you've got to be making micro adjustments at the wheel to stop yourself sliding on either the front or the back end. And that's where the best drivers, your Verstappen's currently, Hamilton's, your Schumacher, Senna, these guys have such an incredible natural feel where they can feel what the car is going to do just milliseconds, even microseconds, before the other great drivers.
And that's not something you can teach them? That's something that's...
I wish you could teach it. I would have been better, but I couldn't. So I was probably a driver working really hard to understand the car. I was looking through the data, trying to understand what the guys were doing and trying to learn it a little bit more. And everyone's doing this as well. This is, you know, no one's resting on their laurels. Even the most talented guys are still in the debriefs working hard and hustling. But you try and make up for it. And I was, let's say when I was teammates with Hülkenberg, looking at his data when he was quicker than me, and I was trying to work out how I can adapt and get to that level. But there's a certain point where one person just has a slightly better feel for the car than the next, and it's really subtle. The differences in Formula One generally are minuscule. We talk about thousandths of a second defining a grid position or even a row defined by hundredths. I mean, it's tiny, tiny margins, and that is the feel. And I think for the really best drivers, you see this sort of innate feel, the car control in the wet. And that's the classic where you see Verstappen, Hamilton, Senna, Schumacher, the legends, don't every time get it right, but 99% of the time it rains and you know they're going to be strong because they just have a seat of your pants. They're just feeling the grip fractionally better than the other guys who are also superb drivers to beat off so many other really good drivers to get to Formula One or win races or whatever else.
Yeah, it kind of takes me back, Christian, to season one with Mika Häkkinen talking about, you know, driving the wet and how you manage it and the feelings and what that, you know, those are things that you and I, although you do have driving experience, I want to give you a nod. You have raced in karts.
A little bit. And use the term race loosely.
Regardless, you know, I think, you know, that's a good listen too, way back when is the way Mika tried to describe a little of that too. You know, Alex, Stephen was asking about quantifying the driver's ability. And you are someone who inputs a lot of stats and figures. And has there been anything that you've seen graphic-wise, stat-wise, that really helps you identify driver ability? Or is it just because of the experience that you have and watching it time and time again?
I think a driver's ability is known from very, very early on. You do get late bloomers. You talk about Mika Hakkinen earlier on. He was a late bloomer in his Formula One career in that he always had phenomenal pace, but he had to wait for the opportunity to become a Formula One world champion, had to wait a really long time to even become a race winner. So, but the underlying fact that the entire paddock knew that he was a rapid driver, that when his chance eventually came along, he would be incredibly quick. So very early on, a driver's trait and a driver's skill and a driver's limitation is known. And then it's a case of, can they progress? But as Jodian said, when it's such fine margins, there is always going to be a very apparent gap between the good and the great. And anyone who does make it to Formula One is absolutely phenomenal to have got that far. And the great drivers, the drivers' names that live long into the future, have that final 0.2 of a second.
And it's a lot of it's about consistency as well. There are so many drivers you can list their great day. There's a lot of race winners on the current field. Someone like Lance Stroll has had a pole position. He's led a Grand Prix for a very long time, had podiums. You know, a lot of people can have a really great day when the car's hooked up and they can drive like a champion. But what makes probably the greatest is that they can do it every season. More often than not, they're producing these sort of drives. And in cars that maybe don't always suit them, they're able to extract more, and other drivers might wilt a little bit more.
Stephen, great question. Thank you very much for it. Really great insight from Alex and Jolyon there. And as Jolyon said, he has a series all about driving styles right now on F1 TV. It's called Racing ID, and you can watch that now. Okay, our next question is all about who does what.
Hi, it's Steve from Alaska. I have a question. There seem to be a number of organizations, and I'm not clear on what their responsibilities are. We have F1, FIA, FOM. What does each organization do? And do the drivers have an organization that represents them as well? Love the show. Thank you.
Before we get Alex to answer this question, my understanding is Steve's surname is Steve Haas. Producer Chris, nod if I've got that right. Steve Haas, I hope he changed his name to support his favorite team. I would hope so. That's dedication. We spoke to someone in Texas, Katie, didn't we? You moved to Austin for the race.
That's right.
And named their son Ayrton. Maybe we've now
got someone. They didn't just move in the US. They moved from literally across the world to go to.
Yeah.
But speaking of Austin, Alex, you might remember in COTA in Austin, I asked you a similar question to help me better understand. And there was it's a long story, but there were some things happening within F1, and I wanted some clarification. And it involved the FIA. It involved understanding these principles and who they all are and what they do and why it was important. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. And it is an entirely fair question. So the FIA, the Fédération Internationale Automobile, are the governing body. They set the rules, regulations, and are responsible for the scrutineering. And they are the governing body. They are the sporting side of the Formula One World Championship. Formula One, background on that, Formula One, they were debating what to call this new motor racing championship for drivers and then later constructors back in 1950. They were on the fence in the board meeting between Formula A and Formula One, and they went for Formula One. And you know what? It worked and it stuck and it's proved rather popular. FOM, is the Formula One management. So they are the commercial arm of the sport, and they are responsible for the money side, if you like, and they are responsible for the TV pictures you see, no matter what country you're in, and they look after that. They promote some races. They don't promote all races, but they are the money side of it, and they are responsible for the teams getting their payment. And the last one listed, the question from Steve was, do the drivers have an organization? They do. It's called the GPDA. It's the Grand Prix Drivers Association. It's existed in various forms for many decades and was revived after the death of Ayrton Senna in 1994, has continued ever since, and is the drivers getting into a room and mainly has existed around the safety and equitable conditions for the drivers and ironing out stuff like if you go back to the 90s when it was reformed, safety, especially in that regard.
And would you believe it that Mr. George Russell happens to be one of the current directors of the GPDA? I feel like that suits George Russell.
Yeah, George Russell giving an opinion.
Not
is,
the opinion.
Is a,
no, but like just is, like George Russell would be somebody who would want to sit on a board, like a homeowners association board guy.
Yes.
Like he is totally that guy.
He's 100%.
Yeah.
He fits it. Not a criticism.
No,
in
a wonderful
anyway.
Thing.
George would tell you what he thought, regardless of the being a Grand Prix Drivers Association. So he's a perfect person to lead it.
Yeah, thank you for, you know what, it's so funny, full circle here, for me to have that moment with you, Alex, because again, you were helping me better understand a scenario that was happening, and you were using all of these FIAs and FOM or FOMs and, you know, all this, that, and the other, and to help really streamline that, I think is really helpful for people to better understand when these conversations are going on, when someone's deliberating over this or that, it does help to have kind of a streamlined approach to that. So thank you for explaining that. And I'm sure Steve Haas, wink, wink, Haas being a favorite team, maybe, sir, would you let us know? That I hopefully helps him better understand it, too, when he's listening in. Stay with us. We have so much more F1 coming your way on F1 Explains with Julian Palmer and Alex Jakes. I look forward to diving a little bit deeper into all things F1.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Welcome back to F1 Explains with me, Christian Hugill, and Katie Osborne. We've got Alex Jakes and Julian Palmer with us for some quick fire questions. Next is an email from Daryl. Daryl says, drivers seem to always be wearing brand new team or personnel caps for interviews and such. Are they generally brand new? And if so, what generally happens to them afterwards? Relatedly, what happens to the champagne-soaked podium caps worn after each race, especially the race winner caps? Julian, when you were stood in front of someone like me or Alex or Katie and you were doing an interview, was the cap on your head always new?
I'm not a cap guy, you know. I was actually rarely in a cap. But
really?
Hey,
they
the fashion's moved on.
Don't they? Yeah.
Yeah, they do. What cap? Could be a bucket hat these days. I was never a hat guy, but if I were to be wearing a hat, I guess it'd be pretty new. There's a lot of caps that go around, and a lot of them get you sign for guests, partners, sponsors, fans, and so I think you're probably having quite a few new ones.
Does the champagne smell afterwards on those suits?
Yeah, you're asking the wrong person, Katie.
I was trying to give you a... You cannot tell me if I'm not...
No. You know what? When I was in the junior formula, I had two suits for the year. And so you get them washed or dry cleaned after the race. And otherwise, the champagne, you'd pack up the bag. Yeah, this is in the equivalent of Formula 2, in my more successful days. And... you'd pack up the bag, kit bag, you're wheeling it back, you get back to England and it would reek. So you're doing a full kit wash and to be honest, you're getting pretty sweaty in the overalls anyway. So the champagne is maybe, the champagne mixed with sweat was potent. In Formula One, you have a lot more kit. So you're getting, I think I had sort of new overalls very regularly. Not every single race, you're going through a cycle. A lot of it's getting, half of it's getting washed, half of it's new. And yeah, the sweat smelled pretty bad still, but the champagne unfortunately didn't mask it. for me in F1. But I'm sure a lot of this stuff goes to the team still as well. A winning overalls, that's got to be signed and given to someone, surely.
Does this look familiar to you?
Katie is currently putting to the screen, what, Julian?
It's the iconic yellow and black RS17, that's the 2017 Renault cap, which you will never find one of them on my head. There'll be no picture with me wearing a Renault cap.
But they are on sale. Not on sale, but they are for sale. Don't worry, you're still full price. And you can
really?
Still find that.
Really? So they've not shifted many of them, I'm telling you.
How much do you think a 2017 Renault Formula One team driver's cap, Julian Palmer and Nico Hülkenberg, brand new official merchandise cap goes for? Alex Jakes, how much do we think?
I would go for probably a fiver.
Oh, that's unbelievably harsh, personally. Julian Palmer.
If it's not going for at least $20, then I'm going to be disappointed.
It is going for £34. So we're talking about $40.
Wow.
That ain't bad, is it?
Wow.
And it's brand new. Nobody even has to have a worry of sweater or champagne, if and when.
That's a little overpriced, in my opinion. A little overpriced.
Daryl, so yes, the caps generally are new. A lot of them are auctioned off for charity. A lot of them are given away to VIPs. A former race wear and race suits and caps do raise a lot of money for charity. And we are going to be digging into this in even more detail within the next few weeks here on F1 Explains, when we'll be looking at not only how these team kits are made, from race suits to boots, but also what happens to them afterwards. So coming soon, we will dig into that more here on F1 Explains. Let's read another email. This is from Richard. He's just outside Dallas in Texas. Richard says, I'm enjoying your podcast very much, especially since I'm a Drive to Survive newcomer to Formula One. I'm trying to get some historical perspective. Can you give me a summary of the major rule changes since, say, Fernando Alonso's first F1 race? I'm mostly interested in, we're going to be here a while, I'm mostly interested in changes in engines and aerodynamics. I also find it fascinating that at some point the FIA, we now know what that stands for, was able to decree that there would be no stops for fuel and could still have the same length races. I mean, we've got some information on this, but before we get into that, Alex, it just shows you how impressive what Fernando is doing. It's still competing at the top level, that when he started in Formula One, in 2001, off the top of my head, you'll tell me if I've got that right.
You have.
A lot has changed.
Was Oscar Piastri born at that point? I'm not sure he was.
He was born that year.
He was born that year in the same city. There's a phenomenal amount that changes. There are very few sports on the planet that change their rules as much as Formula One does. So to go back to 2001 and summarize it, I am looking forward to the next few minutes of this podcast. And I'm a guest on this podcast to see if you can summarize all of this history in Formula One. But no, what Fernando is doing is really without modern precedent. He is taking advantage of the advances of sports science, but he is taking us back to yesteryear with the length of a driver's career, where drivers used to race into their mid-40s, but the cars were slower. And the physical requirements were nothing near what you have to do today. So Fernando's still racing. He's redefining what we know in modern sport.
Julian, your last race in F1 was 2017. I'm imagining you look back now and think, that might not seem that long ago, but actually the sport's changed since. Again, I suppose that demonstrates, you know, just what Fernando's done.
Halcyon days, 2017. it's changing all the time. I think generally, since Fernando started, the cars are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Safety is getting better. When I was racing in 2017, we still didn't have Halo, which came in for the year after. So that's the most noticeable change that was year on year for me racing and not. Then the engines have gone from, he was in a V10, then it went to V8. Then now we're into turbo hybrid V6s. So that's going in that direction. And now we're back to ground effect, which is a complete throwback to F1 in the 80s. So there's a lot of change. The cars are so different to drive and even to look at. Now, the size of them they're huge compared to Fernando's 2001 Minardi. And he actually drove his 2006 Renault on track in Abu Dhabi at the Grand Prix weekend a few years ago. And it kind of looked like an alien sport. It looks so different when you see that in full tilt. That was his title-winning one, compared to the Formula One cars now. And yet he's had to adapt. And we spoke about driving styles already. That just goes to show, you know, the minutiae of driving styles. And then you're getting cars that are constantly evolving as well. So you've got to stay on top of it.
Well, Alex just said he was looking forward to this. I'm not sure me and Katie are so much because we've been tasked with doing this. So let's do F1 explains the rule changes since Fernando Alonso started in the sport. Katie, would you like to start?
Let's start with engines. Alonso has driven three different engine types, as Julian was leaning into. V10s until 2006, V8s until 2014, and turbo hybrid V6s ever since.
Alonso has also seen three huge aerodynamic rule changes in 2009, 2014, and 2022, which changed almost everything about the cars. Each time, the weight, width, and length of the cars changed, as did the size and shape of the wings, the amount of downforce generated, and the grip. It all changed.
Yep, and Richard asked about refueling. Now, it was allowed when Alonso started, then banned in 2010 for cost and safety reasons. Car design rules were changed for 2010 to allow larger fuel tanks, which would last the entire race. That made the cars themselves bigger and heavier, thus another change.
And guess what else has changed? Everybody's favourite black rubber things, tyres. Fernando has driven for three different tyre suppliers, Michelin, Bridgestone and Pirelli. Now, the design of those tyres, the type of rubber they're made of, has changed almost every season. He's had to learn, remember, then forget dozens of names for those compounds. Hards, soft, medium, hypersoft, ultrasoft, C1, C2, I could go on. Almost as many name changes as Red Bull's second team. Plus, when Alonso started, the tyres had grooves in them. Then in 2009, they all changed to slick tyres. And then the tyres have got bigger. They used to be 13-inch wheels, but since 2022, they've been 18-inch wheels.
Now, also during Alonso's career, there have been six different qualifying formats, including shootout qualifying, one-shot qualifying, knockout qualifying, sprint qualifying, average lap time qualifying, and elimination qualifying. The last one was only used for two races in 2016.
There have also been four different point systems. The number of points on offer, how many people get them, and when have changed four times in Alonso's career.
The good news is that gearboxes for Alonso, there's only been a few. He's driven fully automatic gearboxes, semi-automatic gearboxes, 7-speed gearboxes, and 8-speed gearboxes.
8-speed's my personal favourite. DRS, the Halo, virtual safety car, the bonus point for fastest lap, and F1 Sprint have all been introduced.
And finally, team orders, traction control, and mid-season testing have been banned, unbanned, and then banned again during Alonso's 23 years and Formula One.
Alex, you said you were looking forward to that bit of the podcast. Alex and Julian, your review on how we did, please.
Very good. A very, very impressive to summarise.
Any changes you guys want?
Yeah,
I'd like to make any changes to it?
More performance-wise, I'd like you to read it again, but this time a little bit sunnier. All right? No, it was absolutely immaculate. That is such a lot of Formula One history to summarise. Completely different eras of car. Completely different weights of car. By the way, my favorite one in there, let me find it, elimination qualifying, right? If you've never seen the top farce that was elimination qualifying, it is well worth your time. Commentators losing their minds, drivers losing interest, and it was junked after two races. It was downright hilarious. I really enjoyed it.
We had a go. We tried something new. It didn't work. We moved on. All fine. Excellent. Right. Final question of this week's episode, and we are back to the voice notes.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I'm from Sydney, Australia. Very big fan of the podcast. I was recently lucky enough to be in Singapore for the Grand Prix and was walking pit lane as the teams were doing their practice tyre changes. And one thing I noticed was it's a very intense, obviously, team effort, but like with any team effort, people make mistakes. And when I think about obvious pit stops where things have gone wrong and maybe an individual hasn't put the right tyre on or hasn't put it on correctly and there's been an issue, what's the mood afterwards in the pits and with the crew? And are there any sort of consequences for essentially potentially costing a driver the race? Thanks.
Excellent question, Sarah. Julian, I'm imagining as a driver, first and foremost, when you're sat there and it's gone wrong and you're driving out again and you've been stationary for what seems like 3 years, It must be the most frustrating feeling in the world.
Oh, yeah. Steam coming out the ears. Maybe you try not to rant on the radio because that's a bit rude. But steam coming out the ears, and because it changes your race when you come in. That's the reality is I had a race in my first British Grand Prix and came in for it started off wet classically at Silverstone and then came in for a tyre change, three wheels on. Did a, had to go out, come back in and get a fourth wheel added to my Renault. And you're like, the whole race has just gone for a mistake in the garage. But these things happen. You know, Daniel Ricciardo's Monaco one was the classic where there was no tyres ready when he came in for the stop. And it does happen. And from a driver's point of view, you spend so many laps just grinding out the last tenth of a second every lap to put together a race. And you can lose seconds in a pit stop easily. And you can lose the whole race if it's even worse than that in the Ricciardo situation or a three-wheeler pit stop. So it's gutting, obviously, for the driver. But the reality is, as well, we make mistakes, which people would be aware of. So there's other times where...
Was that from a driver saying they make mistakes?
Look, I wouldn't have admitted at the time. I would not admit it at the time. When the car's in the barriers, it would have been surely someone else's fault. Usually the gust of wind. But there are times where the mechanics, they're going to be... hacked off at you because you've crashed the car and they've got a late night or you've cost the result or you've done something silly as not got under the pit lane speed limit in time or, everyone's looking for the last little bit of perfection. So the cool light of day would say these things happen. But of course, for the driver, when things do go wrong, the strategies, the pit stops, it's frustrating. But everyone's just looking for the 2 second pit stop, the 1.8. They do so much practice and sadly, some things do occasionally go wrong. It's part of the game.
I guess you win as a team and you lose as a team. Jolien, did you ever go and talk to the pit crew about it and say what went wrong? Or is it just one of those that's like, yeah, well, it happens?
I mean, you would do, of course. Isn't that natural to catch up after the race and figure out what happened? But it just doesn't change the world. You know, I knew when I was in the car that you trust the guys in the garage to be doing a good strategy and B, good pit stops. They can do it. And if anyone's been to the track and been near a pit lane, you will see teams up and down the pit lane, like Sarah saw, that are doing practice pit stops all morning before a Grand Prix. But they're also doing it back in base. They're doing all the way through the winter in the off season. They're doing practice pit stops with an old show car. You know, they are so dialed in, but human error can happen in under a lot of pressure and stress and the rest of it.
So I guess to summarize the question there, the mood is dismal, I would assume.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
dismal.
It's a rank.
But that does actually lead me into a question for Alex, which on the other hand, in a commentary box, when there is an issue with a pit stop, how would you describe the mood in a pit box?
Loves it.
Yeah. That's what I would think.
There's nothing I love more. No, you really feel for them. You do. You try not to jump on every single thing that changes the narrative. You know, you get mistakes which are people's fault, but a pit stop mistake, like those guys have a tough job. They work really long hours and they're feeling it hardest of anyone. There's nowhere to hide. It's obvious it's them. They've got to sit in a room and own that mistake straight away. There's the natural, I cannot believe that's happened. And you try to be diplomatic in that moment and then maybe throw it to the unreasonable racing driver who will tell you the truth. Because the reality of it is that the person who's feeling it the hardest is the person who's caused the error.
And you're getting very excited in the commentary box at this point, though. The thing is, it changes a race, doesn't it? So when you're calling it in the booth, you're seeing, let's say, the race leader coming in, and these are crunch times. It could be a one-stop race. This could be the one job that the mechanics have got to do in the race that can alter the outcome. And it's a big moment. We're so used to them being superb. All the guys up and down the pit lane are brilliant. But when it doesn't go right, it can throw the whole race.
Yeah, no, well said by driver's perspectives and commentary booth perspectives all around. I think that I have a new question for F1 Explains, which is taking a deeper dive into pit stops. And maybe we can get one of those, a tire changer, someone to tell us just what it really takes to go through the efforts and what the practice is like. And you're talking about it back at HQ and, you know, the daily.
You're not allowed to send in a question, Katie. That has to come from a listener. So if anyone would like to hear from that, f1explains@f1.com.
Okay, go ahead and send that one, please.
It's not how it works.
Just let us know if by chance you have the same interest. You know what? I might just do that. I might just send producer Chris a voice note.
And you can only send the podcast a voice note if you're off having a baby. So,
okay, you know, you know, okay. Well,
these are the rules.
Already... For this episode, we thank you two gentlemen for joining Christian and I and producer Chris on another episode of F1 Explains.
Yeah, and if you've got a question you'd like us to answer on a future episode, record it as a voice note, unless you present the podcast, then you're not allowed to, or send it in an email to f1explains@f1.com, and you can hear Alex and Jolyon in action on F1 TV. And don't forget Jolyon's new show, Racing ID, a series all about driving styles, which he's plugged a few times. Well done on getting those plugs in, Jolyon.
We'll plug them for you too. Don't worry about it, buddy.
Brilliant. Always a pleasure, guys. Always a pleasure.
Alex, thank you very much.
Is this the university challenge ending? Thank you very much to you guys.
Yeah. Thank you to you. That's the university challenge ending. This has been F1 Explains with me, Christian Hugill, and Katie Osborne. We are back next week. Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.